much to me to mean that much to you.
Beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, with a raspy voice because I'm dying in here. So don't think I have a sexy voice. I don't. I'm just sick. I'm a professor of communication at the University of Houston downtown, and along with our team, co-hosts Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, syndicator Alondra Mejia, and newest member of our crew, Lisa Moore, we celebrate the power of story by placing the attention on tellers who take us on journeys through enchanted worlds and through windows of their souls with personal stories that stretch the boundaries of a human heart. The 2014 film Still Alice spotlights a linguistics professor and her family as they find their bonds tested when she is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I know a man named Pete, 57. He once revealed, "I'm in great shape and look good, but I feel lousy. And it's getting worse by the day. I was sitting in my favorite chair, thinking about growing up in Pittsburgh. Loving parents, great friends, warm house. Stop the film. I can't visualize anything in my house. I can see foggy images of a couch, yard, and a street sign outside my back door. Or was it the front door? Side door. I was angry, and I was pitiful. Years passed, and... lost my train of thought. Forget what Mom looked like. Dad, too. But you know, it's not a film for Pete. It's the consummate poignant tale, really, one all too common for many of us to tell. Mark Twain said, "When I was younger, I could remember anything, whether it happened or not. But I'm getting old, and soon I shall remember only the latter." Well, dementia is a topic of great urgency, and narratives conveyed by those who suffer from the disease and the family members who suffer alongside their loved ones are plentiful. My guest, Dr. Greg Goetz, is passionate about the study of gerontology and has such a story about a relative who inspired his interest in examining the inadequacies of the healthcare delivery system, especially of dementia care. Greg is professor of sociology at the University of Houston downtown, where he's been since 1997. He has served as coordinator of the sociology degree program and director of UHD's agenda as a member of the Texas Consortium of Geriatrics Education Centers. Prior to all this, he did adolescent substance use prevention at Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Goetz received his doctorate in sociology from the University of Southern California and completed a postdoc fellowship in health psychology and behavioral medicine from University of Houston. This award-winning scholar is well-versed, well-published, and well-bribed to be here tonight. Right, Greg?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I just had to pay him a lot of money. It's amazing. I mean, you know, we're running out of money, Nicole, because we have to bribe people, right? It's just terrible. Okay, but it'll be fun. Greg, I know there's a great crisis in geriatrics, and among the many problems is the dysfunctionality of the structure of residential institutions. They're independent, assisted, and memory care living, and these labels, especially memory care, are largely falsifications. Now, before we talk more about the specifics, it's how you became inspired to devote so much time to gerontology and dementia we need to hear. It was after your mother passed, and you kept up with her first cousin when your curiosity about memory care was ignited. Tell us the story.
Thank you, Hank. Happy to do that. Norma was my mother's first cousin, whom I'd known quite well throughout my childhood. And since she was in her late 70s and was living alone after her parents passed away, I visited several times a year to make sure that she was coping effectively as she aged. And I would take her to meet with her elderly friends or out to eat or just out for a drive, since she had ceased driving after a minor traffic accident. She passed away at the age of 92 from Alzheimer's disease and cardiovascular complications. Perhaps the best short description of Norma would be to say that she was simply a delightful and beautiful person in all possible senses of those terms. She was always pleasant, a pleasure to be around, always extremely gracious, and very reticent to impose on others in any way. She was somewhat reclusive and never married, but lived with her parents, taking care of them until they passed away. She was an avid walker and hiker her entire life. She also loved to travel. Over the years, she'd been on tours to Mexico and Europe. And for 40 years, she worked as a staff person for the local school district, where she was loved and respected by all. It was saddening to watch her decline physically and mentally as she moved first into an independent living facility and then into a dementia care facility. But despite this decline and anxiety for her that such loss would naturally produce in anyone, she never lost her impeccably gracious and good-humored demeanor. With reference to the frustration accompanying her health problems, she would occasionally say, I want to go for a walk and head west till my hat floats, which was her humorous way of dealing with her recognition of her situation. It was this personal experience with my cousin that informed my broader academic interest in the field of gerontology, the multidisciplinary study of the aging process in all its dimensions.
Yeah. My hat floats. So what does that mean, my hat floats?
It means she lives on the Pacific coast, and she was heading west until her hat floated.
Yeah. Wow. What an artistic way of phrasing that. How long, Greg, did she suffer from Alzheimer's? I know she died at 92. But...
Approximately, well, 8 years... post-diagnosis, but mm-hmm. as we know about Alzheimer's, neurophysiological changes begin years before any behavioral changes occur, up to anywhere from 1 to 10 years prior.
And she was aware that she was suffering from Alzheimer's?
She was, but it took a while for that to kick in. Later I'm going to discuss a trajectory of decline that involves... one's initial awareness that something may be going haywire here. We all have memory loss and become more conscious of the hypothesis that it's illness related as we age.
Wow.
That was the case with her, as she did conclude that she needed to... make a reservation, hold a place in an independent living facility, mm-hmm. stop living alone. Mm-hmm. She had to stop driving as a result of this minor accident.
Right.
So she was connecting the dots long before any behavioral decrement kicked in.
Yeah.
It was about a period of 8 to 10 years.
Yeah. Did you know her well growing up?
Extremely well, yeah.
Okay, so she was really,
yeah.
Wow, unbelievable. Thank you. Thank you, Greg. You're listening to my guest, Dr. Greg Goetz, professor of sociology at UHD on So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 in Huntsville. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, with Nicole Rochelin on the boards. Greg, I know it's frustrating to select what to convey in about 15 minutes of telling time, and that's one of the reasons we are moving to 60 minutes. Oh, did I hear myself right, Nicole?
You heard yourself right.
Okay,
yes, you did.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And you know what? We are excited to report that So What's Your Story is moving to Wednesday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m. And it's starting next week with host Dr. Mary Egerton and her guest Ann Clayton. And we'd love it if you keep liking us on Facebook and make sure you check us out on YouTube as well.
Thank you, Nicole. And yeah, Ann Clayton is a magnificent teller. She'll be talking about the process of exoneration and her own case. And Greg Audell and I will be joining Mary next week so we can talk a little bit about prison life. You know, the prisoners are really very important to KPFT. Many of you know the prison show. It's been around a long time. It's the consummate community activist program on KPFT, and we're very, very proud of it. And we're going to be talking about that along with some of the stories that Mary, Greg, and I will be sharing in our 60-minute debut program next week. Love it. Absolutely. And I won't have to take a nap before the show like other seniors, Nicole, you know, right? Right. It's 8 o'clock. I have to take a nap before our show. You know, my wife has to wake me up. Time to go to work.
You know,
it's really pretty embarrassing.
Although I am a young tenderoni.
Although you're a what? What did you say?
A young tenderoni.
What is that?
I'm tender. I'm young. I still
tenderoni?
Got it. A tenderoni, Dr. Hank. Tenderoni.
I mean, I got to tell you, I've never heard that before. Really?
Well, for the first time, I can say I actually taught you something.
Yeah, you're right. Let me teach you something. The other day, I was reading about a woman who was giving sexual favors for... Oh, yeah, no, it's a true story. Sexual favors for spaghetti dinners.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, spaghetti dinners. And I think that probably makes her a prostitute. I just thought I'd mention all of that to you. Right? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like we always say, always great things here.
I know. So tell us what else is going on in Storytown.
Yes. Well, as a friendly reminder that our sponsor, the Houston Storyteller Guild, meets the fourth Tuesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 at the Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. And don't forget our friends at the Moth, the second Tuesday of the month at Warehouse Live.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Greg, you know, asking you to give us a synopsis of problems that are associated with memory care is the tallest of orders. And unfortunately, that's what I'm going to ask you to do. Kind of synthesize these problems for us, because there are so many, it's unfathomable.
There are many, and they're interconnected, and we don't have time to cover the entire waterfront, but I'll be happy to indicate what, in my experience, constitutes mm-hmm. some of the dysfunctions of dementia care facilities. However, as a prelude to noting some of those dysfunctions, I want to acknowledge that, in my experience, the employees of such institutions are generally conscientious, hardworking people who have a very difficult job to do. There's a growing literature on the stressfulness of being a caregiver, whether that be as a family member or as an employee in a facility. So my criticisms of dementia care facilities are sociological in nature. They involve the organization and structure of the facility as a total institution, which we'll come back to momentarily. Having said that, in my experience, observing a few residential nursing and or dementia care facilities from a sociological perspective, there exists social structural deficiencies relative to the needs of a proportion of the residents, not all the residents, a proportion. And to explain what that means, it's necessary to juxtapose awareness of an Alzheimer's disease victim's trajectory of cognitive impairment against a description of the care facility as a total institution. So, beginning with the cognitive impairment trajectory, imagine a 7-point scale demarcating stages of cognitive and physical decline experienced by the victim of dementia. For example, someone diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. This 7-point scale is known as the global deterioration scale in the literature. Stage 7, the highest level of severity, entails the stereotypes you may have run across with regard to Alzheimer's disease. It involves the loss of all verbal abilities. It involves the loss of psychomotor skills like walking. It entails incontinence, required assistance with hygiene and feeding. And under those circumstances, one might infer that the personhood or the selfhood of the individual has dissolved. Monitoring and care required for such patients suggests the reasonableness of their residing in an institutional setting. Okay, backing off from this most severe stage, stage 7, stages 6 and 5, reflecting moderately severe and moderate dementia, respectively, might also reasonably warrant institutional care. However, as we continue backing off of the intense severity levels, and I don't have time to discuss in detail the characteristics of stages 6, 5, and 4, but what we see is less and less dysfunctionality, that is, less and less memory loss, a greater capacity or a lesser loss of short-term memory, still retaining long-term memory. Memories from childhood can be brought back in a second, whereas what happened this morning is gone. Okay.
Right.
But at the level designated as mild cognitive impairment, that would be stage 3, the earliest clear signs of memory deficit are detectable mainly by trained clinical interviewers, not necessarily by friends. Short-term memory deficit may be recognized by the individual experiencing it. Individuals may lose items or forget how they got to a current location. Coworkers may notice poorer performance, but not to the extent that this person is ill, this person is an Alzheimer's candidate. Stage 2 involves the subjective detection of memory problems, not necessarily at all detectable by others. Sometimes people at stage 2 perform below the average for age on a standardized memory test. Stage 1 involves no behavioral impairment whatsoever or cognitive impairment, although neurophysiological changes may be going on in the brain that aren't detectable except upon autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what all this means, relative to my primary point, is that while a patient's deficit level at stages 3, 4, and 5 might make them eligible for residence in a dementia care facility due to an Alzheimer's diagnosis, they still remain persons. They're still sentient beings with a self-concept, a self-image, concern for self-esteem, concern for their human dignity. That, especially for members of American culture, is linked to personal autonomy and independence. So my argument is that there's a mismatch between that need for socially reinforced human dignity and the social structure of dementia care facilities understood as total institutions.
Yeah.
What is a total institution? This is a concept developed by Irving Goffman in a book called Asylums, published in 1961. His definition of a total institution is, it's a place of residence and work where a large number of like-situated individuals cut off from the wider society for an appreciable period of time together lead an enclosed, formally administered round of life. Examples would be prisons, schools, army barracks, monasteries, nursing homes, mental institutions, and I would add dementia care facilities. Mm-hmm. The primary goal in such organizations, such institutions, is social control in the service often of commercial profit. Dementia care facilities are commercial entities, like just as General Motors doesn't exist to make cars, it exists to make money. That's true of dementia care facilities. The high end is $7,000 to $8,000 a month in such a facility. That's, you know, give or take, depending on the state, depending on the paucity of institutions in a particular region. So the question becomes, what are the social psychological outcomes for residents of total institutions, including dementia care facilities? Goffman's short answer to that question is the mortification of self, the death of self, experienced as the negation of the capacity for successful impression management, one of Goffman's key concepts. So specifically, we're talking about the negation of personal space, physical and psychological, the negation of control over one's personal information. The facility has that at their disposal. The patient has no control over it. Thirdly, the negation of privacy vis-a-vis the staff as well as other residents in the institution. The environment is it's a social environment of surveillance. And because of the high staff turnover in such institutions, ranging from the low-level, least-paid, undertrained staff, who constitute the largest number, right on up to the chief executives of these facilities, there's high staff turnover. What does that mean? It means that the surveillance is largely surveillance by strangers. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what this amounts to is a forced abdication of autonomy, self-control, and self-efficacy in the advance of psychopathological necessity. People at stages 2, 3, and 4 of the impairment scale are still persons, okay? Their psychopathology may be diagnosable and recognizable, but they're capable of recognizing disrespect. Okay, the environment, the social environment of the institution, is subjectively experienced by the patient as an assault on personal dignity, resulting in irritability, anger, and hostility, frequently expressed. So there are institutional strategies or social control resulting in the mortification of self. One, for example, is the medicalization of resident behavior. Expressed agitation, anger, and hostility is seen by the staff of the institution as a symptom of the patient's illness instead of a normal reaction to disrespect. Okay? What is the response to the medicalization of anger, agitation, hostility, and disrespect? Often it's medicating. It's medication to control socially disruptive behavior. Sometimes that medication takes the form of antipsychotic drugs as recommended by the physician, drugs such as Seroquel, Zyprexa, and Risperdal. These are drugs designed to treat schizophrenia, psychosis. They are often have been prescribed off-label to treat the elderly in dementia care facilities who are engaging in some kind of socially disruptive behavior. It's been discovered that the elderly react differently to these medications. Their death rate from cardiovascular problems is a little bit higher, linked to these medications. Since 2005, the off-label prescription of antipsychotics to elderly people has been disapproved, but it's still being done. This was attempted with my cousin, at which I was outraged. So this exemplifies the way in which the system is structurally organized to maximize social control at the expense of the psychological well-being of individuals who don't yet warrant the total lockdown approach represented by the institution.
You know, it's amazing that, the idea of imagining that a person is a person, if he or she sits on a certain scale, is beyond comprehension, frankly. It is. It's just beyond comprehension. And you're talking about the clinical interview. Give us an example of one question, just one question that they would ask in a clinical interview to diagnose someone.
One question would be, can you count forwards 7 digits at a time, or serially subtract 7 digits at a time?
Wow.
Another would be, draw a circle, and then pretend the circle is a clock, and make the hands say 25 after 3. Okay? People with with dementia are often unable to do those things.
Yeah. We've talked about the power of storytelling a lot of times, and stories are very powerful. And, the one about your cousin, stories really work. Warren Holloman, one of our hosts, is a maven in healing stories, and his methodology and stories always amaze. And there's an organization called Time Slips. It's a nonprofit agency that started in Milwaukee in 1998, offers a simple revolution in elder care by infusing creativity into care relationships between staff and residents, something that no one we've ever known has ever done. And they train caregivers in award certification and a special method of storytelling. Greg, we've never done a program on this topic, and I'm really grateful that you took the time to join us tonight. I know that there is so much more to say, and I apologize for having a having to cut you off, because I know there's so much to share. You convey the poignant, fragile nature of dementia through your story and your profound insights about the fragmented system of memory care on which we rely confirms your dogged commitment to finding answers. I'm proud to call you a friend and a colleague, reminding all of us that this is our final Thursday, because next week, thanks to you, we're going to be returning to, not turning, but we'll be tuning, you'll be tuning in. I can't even talk, it's the cold pills setting in. You'll be tuning in on Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m., yes, a full hour, and much earlier of So What's Your Story, because all of you rock our world. This was a marvelous show tonight with Dr. Greg Goetz. Scooter is up next with the inner side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m., boy, that sounds good, for So What's Your Story, and let us help you take well-deserved evening breaks. Keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Greg, Warren, Mary, Nicole, Alondra, Lisa, and I will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. See you next Wednesday. Peace.
Got science? The Woodlands Children's Museum is calling all young Einsteins to join in on the learning fun at Science Palooza. The museum will host a different interactive science experiment every day of the week. enjoy some slime time, make magic magnets, learn about everything from ice orb erosion to rainbow volcanoes. The exploration will happen at the museum located at 4775 West Panther Creek Drive, Suite 280, every day from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 11th to Saturday, March 18th. The activities are included with museum admission. For a full list of scheduled experiments, visit woodlandschildrensmuseum.org or call 281-465-0955. KPFT Houston. 465-0955. KPFT Houston.